Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the giveaway to Wall Street that was cynically masked as a pro-farmer bill, the Commodity End User Relief Act, which passed in the House by 246 to 171, designed to help Wall Street banks and the Koch brothers avoid regulatory scrutiny, allowing for riskier trades of the kind that brought about the 2008 crash. Bartlett Naylor, the financial policy advocate at Public Citizen, who served as the chief of investigations for the U.S. Senate Banking Committee, joins us to discuss the Republican strategy of cutting enforcement budgets and imposing cost-benefit analysis as a way to undermine oversight and slow down implementation of the Dodd-Frank Reform Act, and the president's promise to veto this bill because it offers no solution to address the persistent inadequacy of the CTFC's funding. Then we'll examine the warning by Senator Patty Murray, who negotiated the last budget deal on sequestration relief with Congressman Paul Ryan, that Republicans are heading for another government shutdown unless they make a similar deal that sequester relief is done equally for defense and non-defense spending. Jim Manley, a 21-year veteran of the U.S. Senate, where he served as senior advisor to Majority Leader Reid and the late Senator Ted Kennedy, joins us to discuss whether Republicans are capable of avoiding another government shutdown this fall. Then finally, we'll assess the implications of a new survey by the Pew Research Center that finds at least half of Germans, French, and Italians are against using force to defend a NATO ally if attacked by Russia, with only 38% of Germans seeing Russia as a threat to its neighbors and only 29% blaming Russia for the war in Ukraine. Andrew Michter, a senior scholar at the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars and author of The Limits of Alliance, NATO and the EU in North and Central Europe, joins us. And joining us now is Bartlett Naylor, the financial policy advocate for Public Citizens Congress Watch Division and the principal of Capital Strategies Consulting, Inc., which works with progressive organizations attempting to reform public policies where corporations play a key role. Formerly, he served as the chief of investigations for the United States Senate Banking Committee, where he led probes of the savings and loan crisis, corporate takeovers, and insider trading. Welcome to Background Briefing, Bartlett Naylor.
Thanks very much for having me.
And the bill that passed looks like it's heading for a veto, but it does, I think, indicate the extraordinary fealty that the Republicans have towards Wall Street and particular people like the Koch brothers, who really are the beneficiaries of this attempt to basically gut the CTFC's ability to regulate. And I don't think the public knows the extent to which the Koch brothers' fortune. They inherited a relatively small oil company and pipeline business from their father, but they grew it into about $100 billion fortune, largely through commodities trading and Wall Street trading. So is this your understanding of what's really behind what was masked as a pro-farmer bill?
I think you accurately describe this bill as a vehicle that enables the gambling part of derivatives. Derivatives, big word that basically is supposed to involve hedging, where farmers are able to solidify the price of what the crop that they're growing over many months will sell for and establish stability. But it has been overtaken by just the gambling part of Wall Street. The Koch brothers do own mainstream businesses that they've discovered, as well as other commodities businesses, that you can make more money gambling than actually producing and selling the product. So, yes, this bill generally serves the gambling side of the industry as opposed to, if you will, the hedging side.
But the consequence of this gambling casino using the commodities futures trading floor as a way to it was designed to protect end users. Like, for example, if you're going to buy commodities futures for oil, the people that have a concern about that would be an airline industry, for example. They wanted to be able to hedge for future prices of gasoline for their airplanes. Or Pillsbury would be concerned about the future prices of grain. But it has long since lost that connection with its end users, and most of what goes on Wall Street with commodities is basically extorting the American public by driving up the price of food and particularly gasoline for no purpose but to make money for Wall Street at the expense of working and middle-class Americans. Is that not the reality?
Well, that's my view. So normally, commodities should have two players, the people that produce the commodities and the people that use the commodities, the farmers that produce the grain and the bakers and so forth and the food manufacturers that use the grain, the oil or energy companies that produce the fuel, and the end users, namely the airlines or the railroads or the trucking companies that use the fuel. Now, there is a role for the speculator, the people that aren't actually going to use this commodity, and the role is that they serve as, the economists call it, price discovery or liquidity. In other words, that with more disinterested people involved in this, that it can help with the accuracy of the price. But in fact, if you look at the statistics, the number of people that are involved in commodities trading or derivatives commodities trading, which are synthetic devices that really no commodity is involved, have swamped the actual real producers or end users. And it really is just, it is in effect all of us gambling on sports bets. We don't own the teams. We're not the players themselves. We're just standing on the sidelines betting. And to the extent that these are major institutions who, when they fail or falter, we bail them out, then it's not only socially dubious, but it has put U.S. taxpayers on the line for this.
Again, I'm speaking with Bartlett Naylor, who is the financial policy advocate for Public Citizens Congress Watch Division and the principal of Capital Strategies Consulting, Inc., which works with progressive organizations attempting to reform public policies where corporations play a leading role. Formerly, he served as the chief of investigations for the U.S. Senate Banking Committee, where he led probes of the savings and loan crisis, corporate takeovers, and insider trading. But just to verify the opening, where I mentioned that the strategy on the part of the Republicans appear to be cutting enforcement budgets and imposing cost benefit analysis as a way to undermine oversight and slow down implementation. There's no question that they've cut the CTFC's budget, and this, of course, this bill that we're talking about was a reauthorization of the CTFC. They've also just announced today they're cutting $840 million out of the IRS and its ability to collect money and enforce tax laws. Isn't this fairly obvious that this is going on? At least let's start with the crippling the enforcement abilities of agencies like the IRS, CTFC, and the SEC.
It is what I would say a cowardly way to oppose enforcement is rather than actually change the rules, you just change the power of the law enforcers to actually employ the law enforcement personnel to do what's necessary. In other words, take off the IRS people from trying to find the tax cheats and the people that are secreting their money in Swiss bank accounts and so forth. With respect to the cost-benefit analysis, that's one of the most pernicious but often used techniques. On the surface, cost-benefit analysis sounds good. We would all like the rules to benefit more than the cost of compliance and so forth. But in reality, the cost-benefit analysis that's embedded in the bill that cleared the House last night is such that it's impossible, or they, for example, require that the agency consider all alternatives. Apparently, there's an infinite number of alternatives and do the cost-benefit on each one of them and then find this magical one that generates the most benefits for the least cost. Well, it's simply unworkable. And should you think that the agency, you in the industry, think that the agency did not engage in this infinite analysis, you can sue and block the rule. And you think that might be a paranoid fear, these lawsuits are common. The reason that the Republican, in this case mostly Republican congressmen, advance these bills is because they are watching the courts and they're seeing the most common person is the son of the Supreme Court Justice Antonin Scalia. Eugene Scalia brings these lawsuits based on the cost-benefit analysis. And more often than not, they prevail.
So is there, though, some indication here that the Democrats are showing some backbone? I know it's a huge, they almost trip over themselves, congressmen and senators, to get on the banking committees because they get showered with money from Wall Street. And quite often the Democrats have sold out the American people and voted with the Republicans. The worst example was back in December when Obama had to sign the must-pass government budgeting bill, the so-called Cromnibus. And that reinstated subsidies for the riskiest types of derivative trading, subsidies that had been eliminated by the 2010 Dodd-Frank law. And then last year, 46 Democrats joined all but one Republican in voting for a similar bill, this with, of course, the only dissenter being Representative Walter Jones, a Republican of North Carolina. But it does seem in this vote that just took place last night for this bogus Commodities and Commodity End User Relief Act, it passed by 246 to 171. It doesn't look like, it looks like fewer and fewer Democrats are going along with this raid on the Treasury and fleecing the American people.
Yeah, and I think that's exactly right. This was a victory. This is a pretty perverse town when the side of reform loses, and we actually smile about it because the margin of victory was much less than we had feared. This is a split government with a constitution that, for better or for worse, empowers minorities. And in this case, this works to our benefit. A president can veto a bill, and to the extent that Congress cannot muster a two-thirds majority to override his veto, then his veto is sustained. In this case, the Democrats mustered well over a one-third dissent to this, which essentially sustains the president's veto. So the bill, which on the surface passed with an ample majority, essentially was nevertheless a failure.
And the president has issued the veto threat, saying that this bill offers no solution to address the persistent inadequacy of the CTFC's funding. So I take it that the Obama gets what they're up to. Right?
Yes. And I think it's important because you said that winning a place on the banking committee or winning a place where one has a vote in Congress over money, banking issues, commodities issues, mainstream banking issues is a plum because you're going to get showered with campaign contributions. That's been a pernicious hazard that those of us in the reform community have to face because while we may have a sense that Republicans would be more sympathetic to Wall Street, we are faced with the fact that too many Democrats find it necessary to raise funds from Wall Street, and it's difficult to get them to pass what we think are obvious reforms because they are spending their afternoons making phone calls to Wall Street and raising money. But in this case, it was extremely gratifying that out of the Democratic caucus, there were only eight out of the roughly 180 members of the House of Representatives who are Democrats voted with the Republicans, and 171. That's a margin that's far larger than any other margins that we've seen on these banking bills. And again, as we're discussing this, this is pretty arcane, obscure stuff. A Democrat wishing to raise money might choose to hide behind the obscurity of this because he or she may not be held to account by their constituents who are otherwise concerned about immigration or choice or other mainstream issues. This is a pretty arcane issue, so it's extremely gratifying that apparently Democrats believe that they are going to be held to account for these banking issues.
And of course, in the case of the reauthorization of the Commodity Future Trading Commission and this bogus bill that we're talking about that passed last night, the Commodity End User Act, End User Relief Act, that was touted as helping family farms and ranches, even though the text of the bill barely mentions that. The committees that have jurisdiction over the CTFC are the Agriculture Committee, aren't they?
That's right. That's right.
So do they get showered with money too?
I'm sorry. Did they what?
Do they get showered with money, Ag Committee guys?
I think if you had a choice, and if you were just thinking about fundraising, you'd rather be on the House Financial Services Committee, but the House Agriculture Committee enjoys the fact that they have authority over the commodities trading, and they're certainly not going to yield that to the House Financial Services, formerly known as the House Banking Committee. So, yes, they well know. And I should say, the Democrats on the Ag Committee are the ones that mostly populated those 8 Democrats who voted, in my view, the wrong way.
Mm-hmm. So what's your sense then of where the reform community is? You were saying that, you know, that you're fighting the good fight, but you're up against an avalanche of money. And, you know, the Koch brothers obviously are in this. They've joined in with the Wall Street lobbying blitz to stifle and thwart the Dodd-Frank Act.
Well, I think there's good news in the last couple of weeks. I'll start with this bill in particular. It is gratifying that so many Democrats have resisted this campaign contribution dynamic and have voted in my opinion the correct way on this bill. You're actually seeing from a broader perspective, you're seeing candidates for president in 2016 speak out against Wall Street. I mean, yes, Elizabeth Warren, the non-candidate, has spoken out, and of course Bernie Sanders, who is certainly very left. You're seeing Martin O'Malley, who as a Maryland governor was seen as a fairly moderate person, but now you're even seeing Jeb Bush. Now, his criticism is couched. He criticizes Dodd-Frank, but I think it was instructive that he said he criticizes Dodd-Frank in part because it didn't address the central problem that we face, and that is we have too few banks, or we have some mega banks, you know, the J.P. Morgans and the Citigroup, that are just too large. And I don't mean to be Pollyanna. I realize that, he's unlikely were he to become president, would he break up the banks. But I think at least that reflects that the rhetoric, both on the Democratic side and the Republican side, is such that big banks have very few friends among leading politicians.
But in terms of the commodities thing, and you pointed out how it's masked in obscure, impenetrable data and regulations, and it's hard for people to get a handle on exactly how the commodities are being gamed and the extent to which it impacts the lives of ordinary people every time they go to the pump at the gas station and put food on the table. Rarely does the press cover it, and every time the price of gas goes up, it's always attributed to a fire at an oil refinery. And it was back in, I think, about 2008 that CBS's 60 Minutes did an investigation into the record high price of gas, which went up to $147 a barrel, pointing out that almost all of the run up in the price of gas was to do with the big banks betting on oil futures through the Goldman Sachs index, and that they had tankers sort of going around in circles all over the world. To me, that is the most hideous form of ripping off your fellow American, because it doesn't produce anything. All it does is produce profits for speculators and gamblers on Wall Street, but it produces a lot of unnecessary pain for the average consumer. And I've never understood why there's not more outrage amongst the public, but I guess they simply don't know about it, right?
Well, I think you deal with a major ontological issue that some of the world's worst problems are built on the innocent unknowingly contributing to the problem. I mean, it's our job to try to make sure that the ignorance is eliminated, or the secrecy is lifted, and I appreciate your efforts in helping that. But when galactic big things happen, it's because unfortunately, people are doing things they know not what they do.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us here today, Bartlett Naylor.
Thank you.
And again, I've been speaking with Bartlett Naylor, who is the Financial Policy Advocate for Public Citizens Congress Watch Division and the principal of Capital Strategies Consulting, Inc., which works with progressive organizations attempting to reform public policies where corporations play a key role. Formerly, he served as Chief of Investigations for the U.S. Senate Banking Committee, where he led probes of the savings and loan crisis, corporate takeovers, and insider trading. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back examining the warning by Senator Patty Murray, who negotiated the last budget deal on sequestration relief with Congressman Paul Ryan, that Republicans are heading for another government shutdown.
Get from out the road when you get dough, it's horrible. Time is money, spend, waste, save, invest, affest. The 10K, so cave a chicken chest, S. Yes, y'all are dumb and get your trickles. The best ballers pitch in and rub to get a nickels. But tut tut, he about to change the price again. They go up each time, he blow up like hydrogen. Villain here, albums shrilling in fear. And won't stop top bill until he a gazillionaire. Villain, his agenda is clear. Ending this year with dividends to spare here. A new meaning to sales through the roof. Guaranteed.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Jim Manley, who's a senior director at Quinn Gillespie and Associates Public Affairs in Washington, D.C., and a 21-year veteran of the United States Senate. He served as senior advisor to Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid for the past 6 years, and before that served 12 years as an aide to the late Senator Ted Kennedy. Welcome to Background Briefing, Jim Manley.
Thanks, Ian. Nice to be on with you again.
And likewise, Jim. Today, your former boss, Harry Reid, said the Republicans did it once. They're going to do it again. They want to wait until the fiscal year ends and then close up government. So how are the minority party going to blame the majority party for another shutdown when the majority party, the Republicans, are going to say, well, you Democrats are causing the shutdown because you didn't agree with what we the majority
sure.
are doing.
Yep. A couple different things. First of all, it's going to be because the Republican budget is so out of whack with where the American people are right now. I don't think they're going to have much of a leg to stand on. That's number one. Number two, including in all those appropriations bills are all sorts of over-the-top riders, policy riders, designed to gut environmental protection, abortion rights, clean air regulations, you name it. And the third thing that's going to happen is that it's going to become crystal clear in the next couple months that all Republicans can do is legislate by crisis. We have a cliff coming up at the end of June over funding for the so-called Export-Import Bank. Once again, a cliff is coming up in July, funding the all-important highway programs. And then, of course, the big enchilada in the fall is we're going to have to redo the debt limit again. So I think that what Senator Reid obviously has done and Senator Murray, who you mentioned earlier, has done is the right thing. Democrats have had it up to here. Republicans agreed to these cuts, and now they're trying to run away from as quickly as they can.
So the sequestration, though, that goes back, to 2011, I think.
Right. 2011, correct.
It was designed to spread the pain evenly between Democrats who favor domestic spending and Republicans who favor defense spending. And my understanding is what's happened is the Republicans have found a way to wiggle around the defense spending by basically playing gimmicks and funneling huge amounts of military spending into these emergency spending bills for contingencies. That's what's going on, right?
That's largely correct, yeah. But let's peel it back one more layer. The dirty little secret about this so-called sequestration deal that Republicans and Democrats agreed to in 2011 is that it was such a stupid idea, such a ridiculous idea, that no one thought that they were going to have to go through with this process because the cuts were so punitive, not only to defense, but to domestic spending as well. So everyone thought at some point reason would prevail and Democrats and Republicans would sit down and negotiate a global agreement. But as Senator Reid pointed out yesterday, I mean, it's now stupid, is now officially Republican policy, at least in the Senate. So that's where we are. So, yes, another layer to peel back. The funny thing is, if you will, is that this extra money that the Republicans want is included in the president's budget. But Republicans, looking for every gimmick they can, didn't put that in their budget, but they're providing $38 billion, you know, a slush fund in this so-called overseas contingency account, which is supposed to fund, you know, war-making activities in Iraq and Afghanistan. It's nothing more, nothing less than a gimmick. And so Senator Reid, Senator Murray are saying what's good for the goose is good for the gander. If you want to increase defense spending, which everyone agrees is the right thing to do, we Democrats want an increase in funding for domestic spending programs as well.
But Patty Murray, of course, was the first to sort of fire a shot across the bow, if you will.
Yep.
And she's appealing to Republicans to compromise, and she's offering up a four-point plan to come to a budget agreement that trades ongoing domestic cuts, which, of course, the Democrats want, in exchange for a domestic spending cut, which the Democrats want, in exchange for undoing defense cuts, which the Republicans want. Now, we know that the playing field has already been rigged on that. We've explained that. But I think the point about Patty Murray, which gives her credibility, is that she negotiated a deal with Paul Ryan.
She negotiated the original deal in 2011 with Congressman Paul Ryan. Again, under the belief, if you will, going back to that Cold War era logic of so-called mutually assured destruction, their proposal was so onerous it would never go through. But lo and behold, Republicans, you know, keep on insisting to gut the social safety net, more tax cuts for the wealthy while sticking it to the middle class. And so, yes, she's taken it upon herself, or she's now signaled, instead of waiting till the fall when, you know, all of this is going to fall apart, she's suggesting that we start right now so we don't have to legislate by crisis. But the fact of the matter is Republicans are never going to agree to provide additional revenues. They're just going to demand additional cuts in Medicare and elsewhere. And so I guess what I'm here to tell you, Ian, and your listeners, it's going to be a long fall into the winter, because I don't see this being sorted out anytime soon. The Tea Party may be losing its grasp with the American people, but they still have a tight hold, especially over in the House Republican caucus, that's dominated to a degree by, you know, the Just Say No crowd.
But just to go back to the agreement that Senator Murray and Paul Ryan did 2 years ago, they successfully put together a package that provided $63 billion in sequestration relief over the two-year period, which is running out on September the 30th,
yep.
And it was divided equally between defense and non-defense accounts. So, and by the way, Paul Ryan has said that he would be comfortable with a second agreement. So, at least there's somebody in the House that's not totally beholden to the Tea Party caucus.
Oh, there's obviously there are a few, but the fact of the matter is they're far in the minority again, especially in the House. Again, they are never going to come to the table and negotiate in good faith on a global agreement. They're going to simply continue to demand additional cuts in domestic spending. But again, let's go back to the agreement, because since you raised it again, I want to be crystal clear. There was this agreement that everyone reluctantly agreed to, and now all of a sudden the pressure has become so bad on the defense industry that Senator McCain and other Republicans are trying to run away from this agreement as quickly as possible. And all Democrats are suggesting is that the same logic be applied to domestic spending programs. Key programs have faced devastating cuts over the last couple of years because of the sequestration, and we simply want some help provided to domestic spending as well. Because, again, this agreement is in place, and Republicans broke the agreement. They can complain all they want about what Democrats are up to, but the fact of the matter is they broke this agreement.
But since, Jim Manley, since you were the senior advisor to Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid for the last 6 years, I suspect you have some idea about these arcane maneuvers that go on in the Senate. And and it does seem that I'm not sure how Harry Reid's going to pull it off and make it clear to the American public that it's not the Democrats who are putting a spanner in the works this time, but the Republicans. Already Senate Majority Whip John Cornyn is saying the Democrats are committing political suicide. They just don't realize it yet. This is a bad strategy. They've taken a hostage they can't shoot.
Well, first of all, no one knows more about hostage-taking when it comes to the legislative process than Senator Cornyn and other Senate Republicans who have put this country through an enormous amount of pain with their previous efforts to hold the government running hostage to the debt limit and other things. How is he going to pull off? Number one is he's got the caucus strongly behind him. And number two, I think there's an effective case to be made that, again, a deal was made and that what is simply good for defense spending should be good for domestic spending programs as well. I think that once the debate occurs on these appropriations bills and everyone understands how starkly different the Democrat and Republican proposals are, the American people are going to rally behind this strategy.
And
not without risk. I can't deny that. I'm confident that they're going to have the upper hand. But again, to be clear, I mean, Senator McConnell's already called their bluff, if you will. He knew this was coming. So as you may or may not know, once they finish up on the DOD authorization bill, which authorized the policy, the next bill he's going to take to the floor is the DOD appropriations bill that actually funds these programs. He's going to try and call their bluff at the top of this process. The Democratic caucus has made it very clear they're not going to go for this.
Well, but, you know, I guess what the Republicans, I'm not saying they're counting on it, but what's looming out there, I'm sure, in the back of everybody's mind is if there's some kind of military action going on in September, because it comes to a crunch on September the 30th when they run out of money, that it's going to be real hard to vote against another giveaway to the Pentagon.
Well, a couple different things. First of all, again, as I told you earlier, the fact of the matter is this was in the president's budget, so they don't have much to complain about in the first place. Number two, you know, the troops are going to continue to get all the money they need. And number three, this money is not for war fighting capabilities, as I understand it. It's in the account for war fighting capabilities, but it's been added on. See, there was an original $58 billion for war fighting capabilities, which administration thought was more than enough. And now Republicans want to add $38 billion on top of that into this account. So they're going to have everything they need is what I'm trying to say.
Right. So just to be clear here, they're putting $100 billion in an account to fight a war that's not happening.
Correct, yes.
That's
an interesting way to look at it. Who knows what's around the horizon? But again,
right. We have a president who's vowed to get the United States out of wars, and he's trying to do the best he can. And I don't think that the two senators who want to get us into wars, John McCain and Lindsey Graham, have a lot of traction in the country. What's your opinion on that?
I couldn't agree with you more. I think that the more that Senator Graham talks as he hits the campaign trail, the more he's going to turn off people with his increasingly harsh militaristic rhetoric.
So what do you think then of what's going on in this division in the Republicans, which we saw last week with Rand Paul and Mitch McConnell and John McCain and what Lindsey Graham was saying as well? They were, McCain and Graham were really trashing, and so was McConnell, trashing Rand Paul for the stand that he took on protecting the Fourth Amendment. And I find it so ironic, and I don't know how McConnell can get around this. Because he's the senior senator from Kentucky, he's endorsed the junior senator from Kentucky for president, hasn't he?
He has.
Yeah.
Why? Because he's trying to protect his right flank. The policy differences between those two couldn't be more stark. But the fact of the matter is, he was scared about a challenge from the Tea Party, and so Senator McConnell spent all the time that he could for the last couple of years trying to protect his right flank from an attack by the Tea Party, and that included holding his breath and endorsing Rand Paul for president. Something I'm reasonably confident he's come to regret, but, that's politics.
Well, but how are they going to get around this division, though? I mean, I think Rand Paul is really doing well with the American people. That was clearly his audience. He was his fellow Republicans were furious at him, but I don't think he gave a damn. He was reaching out to the American people, and I think that Bernie Sanders is doing the same thing on the left. What's your sense that Rand Paul is somebody to watch?
Well, let me begin by answering it like this. If you take a look back over the last couple of years, you've noticed a converging agreement between the libertarian right and the hard left when it comes to such issues as civil liberties and attacks on, too big to fail on Wall Street. And so I've been watching it happen over the last couple of years. It started with David Vitter joining with Sherrod Brown on a bill to attack too big to fail the banking policy. And then it was joined later on with Senator Wyden and Rand Paul on some of the national security stuff. So there's something going on there. But if you're asking me what's happening in the United States Senate, you alluded to it earlier. Rand Paul is so unpopular within his caucus. Nothing he's going to do this year is going to get done. But having said that, you're absolutely correct. He's not playing to the Senate. You know, after all, the Republicans held a couple of caucuses over the last couple of weeks to talk about, the NSA spying stuff, and he didn't even have the courtesy to show up. So he doesn't even, to debate his own colleagues on his own policy. So he doesn't care about the Senate. But yes, he's trying to tap into a concern, as I alluded to earlier, that joins the far left and the far right. And he's trying to tap into that. And I've said it before, and I'll say it again, but if you listen to Rand Paul on the stump, as God is my witness, you can hear shades of Elizabeth Warren. If you listen real hard, you can hear some of the same rhetoric coming out of Senator Paul that comes out of Senator Warren's mouth. There is something going on that he's trying to tap into, no doubt about it. I think in the by and by, his policies are absolutely loony, and he's going to self-destruct. There's no doubt about it. He's got an ability to tap into some of the stuff.
But do you think there's enough Democrats out there that like the idea that somebody's standing up against more foreign wars and they're in favor of smoking pot, and they somehow don't look at the fact that Rand Paul's domestic program is to hand the entire government over to the Koch brothers?
I think again, some of the rhetoric sounds good to some Democrats, but in the end, I don't think they're going to go for it. No, if you're asking me that question, if a choice is between Rand Paul and Bernie Sanders, they're going to go to Bernie Sanders, is why last couple weeks, I think probably former Secretary Clinton's staff is looking to over their shoulder a little bit to see what Bernie Sanders is up to.
Well, he's doing really well in Iowa, from my understanding.
Well, that's my point. That's my point. Yeah. Minnesota last weekend, it's not an early primary state. He went there, and overflow crowd at University of Minnesota, He's drawn large crowds in New Hampshire as well. So that's what I'm saying. That's why I think they probably spent a little bit of time over the last couple of weeks looking over their shoulder, trying to figure out where he's going, how he's going to get there.
Well, it's all my fault, Jim. I did the first public event for Bernie here down in, well, it wasn't the first, but in L.A., where he's testing the waters, and we had a huge crowd, and it was boisterous and energetic and a fabulous event. And he said that this was this made up his mind to put his foot in the race. So.
Okay. Note to self, we're going to blame you from here on out.
Exactly.
You go.
I just put a target on my back.
Yeah, exactly.
So just in closing then, do you think that Mitch McConnell will I mean, he's vowing to block any and all appointments, including judicial appointments. Is that going to fly?
Well, we'll have to wait and see. The day about 24 hours after he made those comments, he quickly walked them back, realizing how outrageous they are. You know, he's got more than a handful of Republicans who want to see judges confirmed. But no doubt about it, Ian, again, for you and your listeners, while I may reluctantly concede that, you know, House and Senate Republicans may have got a few things done over the last couple of weeks or last couple of months, you know, I can nitpick all of it, and they're going to pass a trade bill, I believe, in the House on Friday. But after that, we're done. The Senate's done. Everything's going to grind to a halt until there's some sort of global agreement on a lot of these issues in the fall. Judges will have to wait and see. Like I said, he's in an untenable position. He's got plenty of his colleagues that want to get judges confirmed. But, again, we'll have to see what the Koch brothers tell him to do.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us here today, Jim Manley.
Thank you, Ian.
And again, I've been speaking with Jim Manley. He's a senior director at Quinn Gillespie and Associates Public Affairs in Washington, D.C. He's a 21-year veteran of the U.S. Senate, and he served as a senior advisor to Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid for the past 6 years, and before that served 12 years as an aide to the late Senator Ted Kennedy. We're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back talking about the Pew Research Center's poll that finds at least half of Germans, French, and Italians are against using force to defend a NATO ally if attacked by Russia. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Andrew Michter, who is a professor of international studies at Rhodes College and an adjunct fellow at the Center for Strategic and International Studies in Washington, D.C. He's the author of several books on European security and transatlantic relations, including the most recent, The Limits of Alliance, the United States, NATO, and the EU in North and Central Europe. Welcome to Background Briefing, Andrew Michter.
Good to be here. Thank you, Ian.
And what's your sense of this new Pew Research study that was just came out that I take it has alarmed a number of people in NATO, particularly, I think, on the U.S. side, and perhaps it's been music to Vladimir Putin's ears that at least half of the Germans, French, and Italians are against using force to defend a NATO ally if attacked by Russia, with only 38% of Germans seeing Russia as a threat to its neighbor and only 29% blaming Russia for the war in Ukraine.
Well, I hate to say, but no surprises here in terms of how European politics has been evolving on the problem of of Russian resurgence along the periphery. The really bad news is that we're looking at the largest, the principal players in Europe, Britain, Germany, France, UK, Italy, Spain, all of them essentially uninterested in fulfilling their obligations under Article 5, should it come to that. The only country that seems to be committed to sustaining the allied obligations is the United States at 56%. But this is an ongoing story. There's been this ongoing buyer's remorse across Europe in the older part, if you allow me to call it that way, where people are increasingly looking at the events on the eastern flank as unrelated to their security.
But if you have Article 5, which is a tripwire, right? If Russia crosses this line, if it's in Estonia or Latvia, we'll come in and defend the Latvia or Estonia. Article 5 was used after 9/11 in to get NATO involved in Afghanistan because the 9/11 attacks were an attack on the United States, and NATO invoked Article 5. So if you say in advance, or if your public says in advance that you don't take it seriously, then you don't have the bluff, do you? You don't have the deterrent factor.
It's not only what you say. It's also what you do, or rather don't do. There's, on the one hand, the rhetoric about reinforcing, strengthening, and reassuring the allies. On the other hand, there are the defense budgets in Western Europe that continue to decline. And keep in mind that Russian military capabilities, while they're still impaired somewhat by the legacies of its Soviet past, it's nonetheless a formidable regional force, especially if you look at it in the context of their modernization program. I mean, the Russians are in the midst of a $700 billion 10-year modernization program right now. They just unveiled new armor, new platforms, both for their new tanks as well as for their infantry fighting vehicles and the whole generation of new equipment that's coming online. If you take into consideration the fact that the United States now provides about 75% of all the NATO capabilities on the continent, Article 5 is increasingly becoming essentially a political declaration with very little to back it up. And incidentally, there's nothing automatic about triggering Article 5. Article 5 requires, again, for governments to make a conscious effort to respond. We're looking at a situation where the balance of power along the northeastern flank of the alliance is shifting dramatically and making the security situation of the Balts, the Nordics, and the Central Europeans really impaired.
But there's also, though, in spite of what's happening in Ukraine, and you know, it's pretty hard to believe that most people don't see the obvious, that Ukraine is not invading Russia, but it's the other way around. But nevertheless, and when I cited the statistics in this Pew Research Center, and the way the Germans see it, they only 29% of Germans blame Russia for the war in Ukraine. That's, you know, that tells you that there's a real perception problem for NATO, and what kind of defense are they offering to the Ukrainians?
It's not really just a perception problem. It's also a question of economic interest. Quite frankly, I would venture to say that a lot of Western Europeans, and you see this especially in the public opinion polling in Germany, but also in the UK and in France, have bought into the Russian narrative that we are the cause of our own trouble, that by enlarging NATO to the east, we've provoked Russia, and we're simply reaping the wind that we've sown out there, so to say. I've run repeatedly into conversations with senior officials from Europe, especially when I speak about the Western Europeans, who are expressing what I would call a buyer's remorse. I mean, Europe whole and free and at peace was a noble idea, but what Putin has done is in effect cleaving Europe into the old Europe or the kind of not quite Europe, if you will. It was easy to make declarations from Berlin or Paris or London about you know, the unity of security and indivisibility of purpose, when there appeared to have been no price tag attached to it. Mr. Putin has crashed the party in Europe, and then the majority of the real interests and commitments are coming to the surface, and the majority of the Western Europeans, in contrast to the former Soviet satellites who feel deeply and profoundly threatened by what's going on, most of the Western Europeans simply want to be left alone and want for all of this to go away. And hence, the German government declares from the get-go, as it conducts negotiations with the Russians, that, quote-unquote, there is no military solution to the problem, meaning that there is absolutely no inclination to provide the Ukrainians with the necessary weapons and equipment for them to have a fighting chance. The policy of Europe is to freeze the conflict as quickly as possible so that everybody can get on with the business as usual.
But in terms of NATO expansion eastward, I mean, Henry Kissinger, for example, has gone on the record suggesting that that the U.S. and NATO did not take Russia's security concerns sufficiently into account.
Ian, an alliance that cannot put a few thousand soldiers in the field, an alliance that, you know, requires 72 hours to even begin to start making decisions, that is not an alliance that is a threat to Russia. And this whole notion that somehow by enlarging the alliance, and I use the term enlargement, not expansion, by the way, expansion is the term the Russians have reserved for themselves in how they talk about the process, that this in and of itself is the trigger of the whole crisis. I find this simply unacceptable.
Well, but the one thing that Putin has done, even though he's got Crimea and he's pretty much intimidated and he obviously wants to destabilize Ukraine, he's also turned the Ukrainian people, at least the majority of the people, certainly in the western part, against him. There's never been that kind of enmity between these two peoples. And at the end of the day, it would seem to me that the limits to his, even if NATO is a paper tiger, as you've suggested, there are limits to military aggression, because couldn't he at the end of the day just simply get bogged down in guerrilla war all across his western front if he gets ambitious?
You're absolutely right that Putin, by taking Crimea, attacking in Luhansk and Donetsk, has generated a very powerful undercurrent in Ukraine that's now creating a new national identity in a country that used to be much more divided on the issue of what constitutes modern Ukrainian nationalism, patriotism, and the like. So in that sense, any sort of notion that he can continue partitioning Ukraine, and I think he will move again with a summer offensive. There are all the indications that he's ready to do so. But there will be a stopping point beyond which resistance, especially in Western Ukraine, will become of the kind that simply will prohibit him from physically controlling all of that territory. But that's not his objective, I would argue. I would argue Putin's objective is to destroy the Ukrainian state and to destroy the Ukrainian government and to force Ukraine to reach an accommodation with Russia on Russian terms. One more comment, if I may. NATO is not a paper tiger in terms of its capabilities and power potential. If you look at the West to Russia kind of equation, you're talking about 8-1 in favor of the Western alliance. The problem is that NATO lacks the political consensus and the political will to respond to this aggression. The Pew data that we're discussing right now is the most visible indicator of that. This is an attempt by the Western Europeans to essentially pretend that Putin did not actually do what he did. Putin has completely upended the whole notion of the permanence of borders and the fact that, you know, there is a normative system for settling disputes in Europe and in the West more generally that the Europeans used to insist on. All of that has gone out the window now, and the Europeans are simply refusing to live up to stand up to that simple realization.
Well, while German public opinion, we've talked about the figures, 38% of Germans do not see Russia as a threat to its neighbors, and only 29% blame Russia for the war in Ukraine. That, of course, doesn't include Angela Merkel, but she obviously doesn't have the backing of the Social Democrats, and even her own Christian Democrats are fairly ambivalent So she seems to be out there on her own. But I don't understand Obama's strategy or lack of strategy here, because and NATO's as well. You know, what they're doing in response to what Putin's doing is retaliating through sanctions, right? You know, let's call it economic warfare. So if you're conducting economic warfare against Russia to punish them in the hope that they will get, you know, back off from any more westward movement, then why don't you help the economy of Ukraine, which is a total basket case? I mean, the Ukrainian economy, they're asking for $40 billion. I think the IMF has offered something like 10. There's 60% inflation in Ukraine, and the GDP has just lost 18%, I think, in the last month, or the last year, I should say.
Well, yes, and if you look at the last Eastern Partnership Summit in Riga, the extent of aid offered to Ukraine was a lot of 1.9 billion euros,
right,
which is laughable considering the needs of the country. Putin is assuming one thing, I'm convinced of that. He's assuming that the Ukrainian state will implode and collapse sooner or way before he really has any real dislocations that would cause him power at home. I mean, Putin is convinced that the Russians will endure more of the stress and strain, especially now that he's awakened Russian nationalism and he's extremely popular at home for the decisions he's made. Why our policy is going this way? I think the answer is quite straightforward. The Russians have linkaged on a number of other issues. The Russians are an important player in 5+1 on Iran. We're looking at a critical decision for the Obama administration on getting a deal with Iran, at least to the point where Congress would accept it, and we can put that at least on the back burner for a while, for a year or two. We have a burning crisis in MENA and especially Syria, where the Russians are playing an increasingly important role, having re-entered the Middle East. So Russian cooperation there, at least Russian acquiescence, is important. And the Russians have demonstrated they can cause all sorts of problems for us elsewhere, selling the S-400 missiles, doing energy deals with China, doing joint naval maneuvers with the Chinese, and so forth. So Ukraine, for the Obama administration, is only one part of the equation. I am of the opinion that we should have provided Ukrainians with the requisite military assistance to allow the Ukrainians to actually stand up to the Russians and have them pay a much higher price for what they're doing. And even in the end, if the Ukrainians would lose that conflict, it does make a difference how that conflict played itself out and at what price would Russia gain control over Ukraine.
Well, Andrew Richter, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
My pleasure. Thanks so much, Ian.
And again, I'll be speaking with Andrew Richter, who's a professor of international studies at Rhodes College and an adjunct fellow at the Center for Strategic and International Affairs in Washington, D.C. And he's the author of The Limits of Alliance, the United States, NATO, and the EU in North and Central Europe. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can scroll down on the right-hand side to subscribe to iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.